On This Week in Enterprise Tech, is WebRTC ready for primetime? Does Cisco own the SDN? And Steve Gibson comes on to scare the pants out of you for Thanksgiving. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 117, recorded on November 24th, 2014. Web security, now free. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Braintree. If you're a developer or manager of a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out Braintree. Braintree's new V0 SDK makes it easy to support multiple mobile payment types with one simple integration. To learn more and to try out their sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/twit. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasier, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But I ain't guiding you by myself. I've got my cast of cohorts and characters here, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii, who seems to be quite happy that he's got himself some sort of band thing. Chibert?
Yes. So Microsoft apparently made a mistake. They sent me a email saying, come down at 1 p.m. on this day to go pick up your band. So I did. And there's no reservation for me.
Oh. And they made it up to you?
But I showed them the email and I said, dude, you made me come down. It's there. Here's the email. So they apparently found one.
So now Chibert is part of the Internet of Things.
Yes, indeed.
Fantastic. Someone else who may be part of the Internet of Things, I don't know if the Internet goes out that far, in Florida, is Mr. Curtis Franklin from Information Week Radio. Curtis, that is a mighty loud shirt you're wearing.
Well, doing what I can to warm up the cold autumn we've been having so far.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, speaking of autumns, let's talk a little bit about, the holidays. This season, why not give somebody the gift of a secure password? A Russia-based website has been making waves with more than 73,000 links to web cameras in 256 countries. What makes this buzzworthy is not that they've linked to so many cameras in so many locations, but that every single one of those links leads to an IP camera that's using a default username and password. With a cache of cameras from Foscam, Panasonic, AVTech, Linksys, and a few no-name brands, the index brings back into the light the fact that for many, government spying isn't what they have to worry about, but rather lazy users and administrators.
Well, lazy has nothing to do with it, because a super complex spy bot is out there and has been since about 2003. At least two sets of researchers from Kaspersky and Symantec have published findings on Regen, a persistent spybot malware that looks to have been keeping track of personal computers at telecom companies since at least 2003. According to both reports, the code, deployment, and analysis inherent in Regen show a sophistication that suggests that a government or pseudo-government entity was involved in its development. Who might release such a thing? On that point, they can't say for sure, but they do note that the hints in the code indicate that it was written in a place where English is the language of the programmers.
Well, in the meantime, our friends in Boston and Tel Aviv and some parts of Sunnyvale have been setting up smart benches in public spaces. These photovoltaic-powered benches are providing both Wi-Fi hotspots and charging stations for the ever more technology-savvy populations. So while New York City uses old payphone locations, Boston and Tel Aviv are adding gathering places for green technology. So my question is, why hasn't Honolulu, with tons of sun, doing the same thing?
Reeling from Obama's net neutrality urging on one side and the ISP's promise of lawsuits on the other, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler has announced that there is no timeline for a vote on net neutrality policy. While he acknowledges that net neutrality is an important issue with a vast outpouring of public sentiment, with more than 4 million people filing comments on the first proposal alone. The FCC chairman has stated that there will not be a vote on net neutrality during the FCC's December 11th meeting, instead opting to make sure that they have a policy that can survive any legal challenge from Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, and an industry that is almost guaranteed to sue over any policy.
Now, IBM is continuing their cloud push with Bluemix. IBM's been on a cloud roll lately with a variety of announcements aimed at everything from email to enterprise applications. Now, they're talking about Bluemix, a system that aims to entice development groups with single-tenancy cloud systems tailored to companies that have embraced DevOps disciplines. Multi-tenancy is the norm in cloud deployment since it's the principle that allows lowest-cost deployments from the provider side. But many have used multiple tenants on a single server as a reason not to trust or depend on cloud infrastructures. IBM is betting that enterprises are willing to spend a little more money for a lot more stability and certainty. Now, we'll just get to see how clear their cloudy crystal ball really is.
Well, Padre, I'm sorry, but the FAA is throwing a wet blanket on commercial drones. So if you're building a business around stunning high-altitude drone shots of special events, you may be required to get a pilot's license for a manned aircraft and fly only during daylight hours and stay under 400 feet, with rules applying to even the lightweight hobby drones, as well as the bigger, more complex units. The FAA expects to have public feedback sometime early next year, and it's guesstimated that these new rules could take years to implement. So my 2 cents worth is the FAA is doing a knee-jerk reaction to those jerks that have been flying near airports and in general breaking the rules of the air. Very much a few bad apples making life difficult for those that are more considerate of the safety of manned aircraft.
Well, for the NSA, it's business as usual. Last week, the United States of America Freedom Act failed to pass the Senate. The act would have required the NSA to specify targets for the collection of phone data before the actual collection of said phone data, and would have reasserted the necessity for the involvement of a foreign actor before the NSA could undertake any investigation. The failure of the bill means the continuation of reverse targeting, the bulk collection of metadata, and an almost complete lack of transparency between the NSA, FISA courts, and Congress. Well, that's it for the Enterprise Blips. Let's go ahead and move straight in to the Enterprise Bites. This one comes to us from the land of SDN. That's right, software-defined networking. Now, for those people who may have forgotten, SDN is the separation of the control and the data plane within the networking. In other words, it allows an application to determine what network resources are needed for any particular action it may be taking. Fantastic way to make more efficient use of the resources that you may have already installed. SDN has been building up for the last couple of years. It's been a hot topic at every interop that both Chi Burton, Curtis Franklin, and I have gone to, and just something that's been a big buzz in the IT industry. Well, it looks like Cisco is now saying it's game over. In Cisco's fiscal year 2015 quarter one call, Cisco CEO John Chambers claimed victory in the SDN arena, saying that it was game over. Specifically, he said, and I quote, "We're winning big time on application-centric infrastructure and pulling away from the startup competitors. We're not only pulling away from them, I think, while they have news left on the table. Well, I think it's game over. I think we've got them." Now, the numbers are actually good for Cisco. This is not just a boast. They have almost 1,000 customers for their super high-end Nexus 9000 switching platform, which is the keystone for their flavor of SDN, which they called application-centric infrastructure. They doubled the number of paying customers for the ACI controller, called the Application Policy Infrastructure Controller. And they've won 600 new customers for the Nexus 3000, which is the scaled back version. So obviously they've got heat. Now, in response, the Open Network Foundation, which really kicked off this SDN craze, has come out and said, look, it's not over. They actually are calling out Cisco for taking an existing standard, in this case, the southbound OpFlex policy protocol, and making a proprietary version of it in order to sell something that only works on Cisco hardware. I want to open this up to my co-host here. Chibert, let's start with you. It is, in my estimation, a little bit douchey for Cisco to take open standards, change them slightly, and sell it only under a Cisco name with a great markup. But that strategy has worked out pretty well for them in the past. I mean, this is not a new thing for Cisco.
No, unfortunately, they've done it time and time again. And it's, you know, you got to keep in mind, My personal opinion is Cisco's not a technology company. They're a holding company. They acquire technology and modify it for their purposes, for the ends of selling product. Can't fault them for that. You know, you got to make money. But the problem is when you create something that's so proprietary and then you go into the IEEE committees and IETF committees and throw your weight around and force them into, well, there's the Cisco way of doing it, and that's the that's an ad hoc. And then there's the IETF or IEEE way. So you end up with two standards. Come on now. You know, we really need to start working together. And if we want SDN to become a reality, I'm sorry, you know, a single vendor installation is kind of rare, especially when you start getting into big corporations where they've acquired other departments or other companies to create different divisions. So you're going to end up with legacy, and not everybody, especially in this economy, can afford to do a forklift upgrade. So I think Cisco is calling a win prematurely. I think they need to go to the standards committees and either convince them that their standard is better and then open it up, or they need to go and add so they can start using some of the open standards, because we're not going to have the internet that everybody wants if SDN is islands of connectivity rather than ubiquitous connectivity.
Right. Curtis, let me go over to you, because I want the enterprise executive approach to this. There's that old saying, which I don't think is as true anymore as it used to be, but it was no one ever got fired for buying Cisco. I mean, if you bought Cisco, it may be a pain in the butt. It may be more difficult to configure, but once it's working, it's going to work, and you're going to get support from Cisco itself. That's sort of been the promise. Cisco doing this, saying, look, we've got SDN. Our application suite works properly. The controller's perfect. It's already in the hardware that you're already going to buy. Just buy this additional licensing package, and you're good to go. That's really attractive, right? I mean, as a hardware geek, I may say, no, this is the wrong way to go. This is philosophically abhorrent. But the executive's going to measure the cost of buying Cisco gear with the potential disaster of buying competing standards. Which way do you think he or she's going to go?
Well, I don't think there's any mystery behind what we're seeing in these numbers, but there are a lot of things that aren't in these numbers. Let's look at a couple of things that are absolutely true about SDN right now. One is that SDN is a big enterprise play right now. If you've got 1,000 users, you don't need SDN. If you've got 20,000 users, if you've got 50,000 users, then you start to need the kind of capabilities that SDN is talking about. Who are most of those really big enterprises using in their core? Well, most of them are going to have Cisco to some extent. The other thing that we don't know is how many of these controllers, these mainframes, they're buying. I mean, is this a case of companies that were at the right point in their refresh cycle, buying a chassis that is future-proof from Cisco and not actually deploying the ACI? When you look at the number of ACI modules that are being sold, how many of those are being sold as one-offs into labs or sandbox applications? Those are the kinds of things we don't know right now. The thing that I'm hearing from pretty much every network executive I talk to is that right now we're in early days with SDN. There are lots of pilots, lots of trials, lots of sandboxes being put up. Practically no production SDN systems are out there. So while Cisco is convincing a lot of their customers to give it a try, I don't think it is nearly time to say Cisco has won the war.
Yeah, and you know, that's what I'm hoping. And it's interesting, Chibert, I want to throw back to you. Both you and Curtis have said the same thing, which is SDN's still young. It's premature to call the game over. But the more I listen to it, the more I think the players, as Curtis said, who are going to really need SDN are going to be the big 10, 50, 100,000 seat enterprises. It's going to be the colos, the data centers, the distribution points. that are probably already using Cisco gear in some way, shape, or form. So for them, it's kind of a no-brainer to stay with them, right? I mean, even if you like the philosophical openness of the Open Foundation, the ability to run SDN across multiple platforms. And in fact, we did it at Interop. We ran it across Extreme boxes, Netgear boxes, HP boxes, even a Cisco box using the our own OpenFlow controller. Do you think there's enough of an onus to force one of those bigger businesses to say, we know you're using Cisco, but go with OpenFlow instead. Use their open controller because it's going to allow you to have more choice when you actually have to forklift upgrade your network.
You know, I hate to say it, but I don't think SDN's really going to be able to succeed until it gets wider adoption. You know, there's all this experiments going on, but the Cisco solution has a merit only in that they're the 1,000-pound gorilla. But SDN's true promise is when you start getting into a virtualized environment. So when you start being able to plug into the Microsoft way of doing SDN, that way you can actually connect. You know, you're not going to want to burn up a ton of interfaces. You're not going to want to have to go and burn through a ton of VLANs. The OpenStack way of doing things just makes an awful lot of sense. And I'm predicting we're probably going to see a OpenStack to Cisco gateway someday, which is, in my mind, kind of counterproductive. You know, why don't we have a standard? And then when you start bringing clouds in, I want to be able to go and do the equivalent of a trunk, you know, get my encrypted link up to the cloud and then break it out into the virtualized environment so that I can connect my cloud apps to the correct domain in the SDN cloud. That's when I start seeing real value, and that's when I think a lot of people will start climbing on the bandwagon. I think Cisco's numbers, while they sound good, really aren't, considering how many networks there are in the world. And that probably reflects a very, very small percentage of the world. And I don't think the rest of the world's ready to dive in. And I'm going to totally agree with Curtis. SDN is still experimental.
Yeah, I think for me, the big development over the last couple of months that I think throws a lot of water on Cisco's announcements that it's game over is some of the research being done by Google and Microsoft, in which you can have an SDN environment that becomes virtualized. It's packaged. Google calls it a container, so that it doesn't matter if your application's running on your own hardware, on your own switches, on your own resources, or move to the cloud. It just runs. You just open up the container and it goes. You don't really have to care about the underlying hardware in that case. And actually, it's better if you don't have a single vendor with proprietary standards, because then otherwise the container would have to have a bunch of hooks that get added to it to work on one platform or another. So while I think Cisco does have a big advantage, they've always had a big advantage in that they are the hardware inside most of the enterprise across the world. I mean, the numbers don't lie. It is a Cisco world. I think SDN is not quite theirs just yet. Let's go ahead and move on to the second enterprise bite. Now, this has been stewing for a while. Now, WebRTC has been one of the biggest will it or won't it stories of 2014. In fact, basically one of the biggest stories since 2011, other than SDN, that's been generating the most buzz. WebRTC is a real-time browser-based HTML5 standard that allows for real-time video communications and collaboration without a plugin. Now, the IETF, that's the Internet Engineering Task Force, and the W3C have been working for more than 3 years to create a stable standard. It's cool tech, the ability to have a stable, easy-to-use communication tool that doesn't require any significant or hardware or software investment. That's of course, very appealing. But while we've seen a lot of demos, not many vendors have actually committed product. It's been mostly vaporware. Let me start with you, Curtis, because you've been covering WebRTC for quite a while. In fact, there was a big push for WebRTC last year at Enterprise Connect. What's your take on the state of the technology?
Well, I think it's one of those things where the technology, to me, there's a great analog to HTML5, to be honest, and there are not a few similarities between them. We have hit a certain level of standardization with both. We have a lot of people talking about demonstrations with both, and yet we have had to this point major companies hanging back until the final standards were announced. And that still hasn't happened. We're progressing along. And believe me, WebRTC has two really huge advantages for the enterprise. One is that it's super simple to implement. I mean, you can use this and embed video conferencing in a web app with about half a dozen lines of code. It really is super simple. The other, and this is even more important from the enterprise point of view, is that it allows point-to-point video communication. Now, as a contrast, if you're using something like Microsoft Link and want to do a video conference with a fellow employee, if you're in Des Moines and they're in Dubuque, but your home office is in San Francisco, well, that call has to be routed through the servers back in San Francisco, which adds tremendously to the networking cost of the entire transaction. With WebRTC, it becomes a point-to-point communication between Des Moines and Dubuque, leaving San Francisco completely out of the loop. That has tremendous advantages when it comes to the cost of video conferencing in the enterprise. So there are a lot of things moving forward with this, a lot of advantages, but a lot of companies have been frightened off by the lack of a final spec on this. And I think you still have a bunch of people waiting for those final nailed down specs before they'll commit.
Right. Cheever, that's basically the pitch that both Curtis and I have heard at every Enterprise Connect for the last 3 years. That's why WebRTC is exciting. That's why it's going to take over the world. That's why it's going to become the de facto standard for communications once we've all moved to HTML5 compatible browsers. So the question I have for you is, why is it taking so long? Why isn't it here? It would sound as if we have both the demand and the technology for it now. Why aren't we all using WebRTC?
Oh, the answer that I see is legacy communications. If you've ever dug down into a standard video conferencing system, say from Polycom or Tanberg or Lifesize, and you start looking at the config items, the number of various codecs involved is staggering. And a lot of these codecs requires licensing. So like, you know, the current WebRTC requires H.264, VP8 codecs, simulcast and scalable video. And the problem is none of the browsers currently support that. You've got to go and start buying plugins like crazy. I had a conversation with Francois Dorimou, the product manager for Microsoft Link. And he brought up something that really didn't get covered that well by a lot of the media. And it's that when you start playing video conferencing of any sort, it's all about where the codecs are. So say, for instance, for thin clients or even any kind of virtualized workstation, any kind of VDI application, if the codec is sitting on the virtual machine, the distance between you and the actual client, say a Citrix receiver or VMware Horizon client or RDP, when you have that kind of separation, all kinds of things break in just about every codec on the face of the earth. So one of the questions is, well, can we get it built into the clients? Well, I think WebRTC is actually a much better solution, an open standard that can be adopted by a whole bunch of people without having to fork over Fort Knox. Maybe, just maybe, when we have something like this, if we get enough big players behind it, like Microsoft and so forth, we might actually start seeing some of the old legacy codecs being dropped away as options. And maybe, just maybe, we'll finally start getting ubiquitous video conferencing that doesn't require the video and audio to loop through a server. No MCU. It's all point to point or point to multipoint. That would be rocking my world.
RJP421 in the chat room is taking an interesting spin on this. He's saying, well, since it is P2P, because that's WebRTC, that's actually one of the strengths of WebRTC. You're not having to go through a proxy or through some central server. But since it is P2P, he said, enjoy sharing your IPs with hackers and trolls. I'm sure we'll have a technical solution around that. But let me throw it back over to you, Curtis, for the last go on this. what's next? We know that there are licensing issues. We know that, as Chibert has said, that there are some legacy issues. We've got browsers that support all those technologies, but no single browser that supports them all at the same time. So you kind of have to cobble things together. And of course, there is the H.264 and VP8 codecs, which are technically proprietary codecs that you have to license. We got news this week that both Microsoft and Cisco are now releasing WebRTC products. For Microsoft, it's going to be Skype. So they're turning Skype into Skype for Web, which will allow you to use Skype and have all the functionality of Skype without having to download anything, without having to install a plugin. For Cisco, it's called Project Squared. Now, they are both taking interesting approaches. They're taking the licensing fees upon themselves. So they're taking the financial hit to use those technologies. But for you, Curtis, what needs to happen in order for WebRTC to start being developed for by individual shops? Like, say, for example, Twit wanted to get rid of Skype, develop its own WebRTC system for use by guests to come into the studio. What needs to happen before that becomes reality?
Well, I think the big thing that's going to be required is for the Microsoft project, the Cisco project, and I have to believe that there's a Google project coming, that sort of thing. Once those companies demonstrate how you put it together, then I believe it will become easier for individual companies to see how it's done, and more important, to see how the licensing is done. Because I strongly suspect that all the different players will start putting together licensing packages. It's the way the industry has worked for the past 40 years. So wait for Microsoft, for Cisco, for Google, and for a couple of other major players to get their projects well underway, to get some initial products out there for companies and individuals to use. And I believe that will work to lower some of those hurdles and knock down some of those roadblocks.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for those enterprise blips and those enterprise bites. When we come back, we are bringing in Steve Gibson. That's right, our security master himself, the author of SpinRight and the mastermind behind Shields Up at grc.com. He'll be on the show to give you some Thanksgiving for security issues. Meh. But before we do that, let's go ahead and take a break to talk about the first sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Braintree. It's code for easy online payments. If you're a developer or a product manager searching for the right payments API, you have to check out Braintree. Braintree's V0 SDK makes it easy to accept multiple mobile payment types in less than 10 minutes with one 10-line snippet of code. Braintree supports all payment types your customers might want, including Apple Pay, PayPal, Bitcoin, Venmo, all major credit and debit cards, plus 130 global currencies. If you're a developer, then you're definitely going to want to use their V0 SDK. The code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. It's in 7 languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. It's elegant code with clear documentation, and it's only 10 lines of in-app code, and then you're ready to run. Braintree has the best-in-class customer service. If you have a problem or question, with Braintree, you'll always get a live person to talk to. And if you're struggling, Braintree will actually handle the integration for you and walk you through the process. Of course, Braintree knows that it's not enough to have easy-to-integrate code and top-notch customer service. They get that what they're offering you are financial services, and that because of that, their security is your security, so they take their security seriously. They're using tokens to secure payment data so the credit card information is never passed on to merchant servers. They're known for their back-end security and merchant protection. That means that Braintree has you covered. It's the fastest, easiest, and most secure way to accept payments, period. It's no surprise that Braintree is the payments API used by companies like Uber, Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, and GitHub. They've made the payment experience in these apps seamless and magical. And now you can have that same magic in your app. Braintree scaled with these companies from early stage startups to the successful companies they are today. So you know that you can scale with their business. From processing your first dollar to your billionth, no matter how a customer would like to pay, Braintree will be there along the way. If you're searching for the right payments platform, check out the Braintree V0 SDK today at braintreepayments.com/twit. Review their documentation. It's simple and concise. Play around in their sandbox. Give Braintree a try with no commitment and test your integration before you actually go into production. And after you integrate Braintree, the first $50,000 in transaction fees are fee-free. That's BraintreePayments.com/twit. BraintreePayments.com/twit. And we thank Braintree for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. We welcome back to the show. I think he was here over 2 months ago. Mr. Steve Gibson. That's right. Steve Gibson himself from Security Now, author of SpinRight, the mastermind behind Shields Up. Steve Gibson, GRC.com. Steve, thank you so very much for coming back on TWiET.
Great to be here.
We brought you in specifically because there's been a few interesting security-based stories this past week, and I thought we could pick your brain just a tiny bit.
Yeah, you guys were talking earlier about Region, which is really interesting. It's Symantec first detected this thing in 2008, so 6 years ago, and it was active through 8, 9, 10, and 11, and then sort of went off the map completely. It just, whoever it was who was behind it, stopped actively using it until 2013, when suddenly it got reactivated again. And the from the analysis, this is like Stuxnet in being extremely complex. It's a sort of a multi-stage installer that has a dropper and then two levels of different loaders that chain together before you get to a modular architecture of kernel level drivers that that are very extensive in their capabilities. I mean, the way this thing looks, there's just no way this is like hobby malware. For example, one of the modules is used for dissecting the protocol used in cellular base station communications, which, you know, requires extreme expertise in that specific discipline. So what we have found is a very widespread, interestingly targeted new kind of malware. For example, 28% of the installations are aimed at the backbone communications infrastructure of telecommunications companies. So everyone believes this is a nation state. And as you guys mentioned, it looks like the language, the original language of origin, is English.
Right. Now, it's interesting. I've heard two pronunciations for this. Some are calling it Region. I've heard it pronounced Reagan. Which one do you use?
Well, it's R-E-G-I-N. So I think you can kind of go either way. I don't really know where it came from, why they named it that. So without sort of getting a clue as to what the source of the name was, it's hard to know how you want to pronounce it. So I was just going Region.
Right. Now, the news that I've been reading about this has been, it's actually kind of fascinating. I know that there are nefarious purposes at play here, but it is ridiculously complicated. I mean, that's why most experts are saying that this had to have the backing of some sort of nation state. It was discovered by security researchers, some of which were at Symantec. As you mentioned, it's been in the wild for 6 years in various degrees of usage. That whole modular approach, the fact that you've got, let's see, what were the stages? So the first part was like the Trojan.
The dropper.
Right, the dropper. That's a Trojan horse.
Right.
Then you had stage one, which was a loader. Stage two extended the loader based on what kind of system it was infecting. Stage three is the initial kernel framework. Stage four is the expansion of the kernel framework to do specific jobs, and then the user framework. And stage five is the payload. So, and each stage wouldn't work until the previous stage was decrypted. So obviously they put the time into thinking, how can we obfuscate this malware so that it's people only know about it once it's too late?
Well, and so what this says is, you know, we've used the term before in smaller contexts, APT, Advanced Persistent Threat, meaning that it's something which typically an enterprise and I'm thinking, for example, RSA famously found this advanced persistent threat in their network, living within their own internal infrastructure. This thing sort of is a A squared, you know, advanced squared persistent threat. And your comment about the way it's been designed to hide suggests that it was the entity behind it knew that they were going to be investing substantially in this. And you need to think of this sort of as a framework onto which can then be plugged modular specific items. So a lot of this is reusable. And then presumably when whoever this is going after a particular industry or a particular country or a particular sector of some sort, they'll design specific components that they then add to this structure. My point is that what this says is, if we're going to invest this much time and energy, we need it to have a long life. And if it's going to be able to exist out on the internet, it needs to be able to hide. It needs to be extremely stealthful. So a huge amount of effort has gone into the stealthiness of this thing.
Yeah, we'll get back to the stealthiness, but I want to bring in some my co-hosts here. Chibert, you first. We've got CR1 in the chat room. I think he's joking, and he's saying, well, as long as it doesn't slow down my nuclear fuel centrifuges, I don't care, because that was Stuxnet. But in a lot of ways, this one scares me more, because whereas we've seen malware and we've seen attacks that are going after intellectual property, they're going out after proprietary business information, this one isn't really an IP malware. This is not looking for your bank account. It's not looking for files on what you're going to be doing next quarter. This was looking for people. So this one was
espionage.
This is espionage. It was isolating individual entities, individual people. And some of the modules that they're starting to dissect here are fascinating. They found one that seemed dedicated to looking at airline schedules. So they're looking for when people are traveling. They found one, as Steve said, that was looking at breaking into GSM base stations so that they could intercept traffic. They also found one that looked for hotel rooms. So they looked for where people were actually staying when they were traveling. So this was a comprehensive suite to track people who were connected to the internet in any way, shape, or form. This is kind of a different level of cyber warfare, right? I mean, now you're going after individuals.
Yeah, this is clearly a human intelligence tool. And this is clearly designed and supported by someone that has the philosophy of collecting grains of sand. There's a saying in the intelligence community is, if you collect enough grains of sand from all kinds of different places, pretty soon you have a beach. And that's what this is. This is a very large organization. Just the way it's set up is clearly a large team. And it's also very clearly someone that has a lot of patience and can do really, really long-term planning. This is definitely something to be afraid of. You know, for people like, you know, that have been in the intelligence community, this is kind of a worst case scenario, because now all of a sudden, maybe that grain of sand is, oh, gee, what did some intelligence community do 20 years ago? Because that will tell me what they're doing now by using building blocks. And that's the kind of human intelligence that someone needs to be really afraid of. And I'm hoping this was written by a U.S. organization, because, man, I sure don't want this for some of our foreign competitors.
Well, I mean, if you look at the numbers, and go ahead and drop over to the Symantec site, Brian. If you look at the infection rates, so right now they're talking about 5% in Afghanistan, 5% in Iran, 5% in Belgium, 5% in Austria, 5% Pakistan, 5% India, 9% Ireland, 9% Mexico, 24% Saudi Arabia, 28% in Russia. So there definitely seems to be a slant. This thing was aimed. It wasn't just let out in the wild. It looks like a lot of those smaller numbers are ways to get to the larger targets. The infection targets themselves, if you break it down even more, go ahead and scroll down a tiny bit more. 5% went to energy, 5% went to airlines, 5% went to research, 9% to hospitality. That's the whole going after hotels and such. 28% telecom. So they're definitely trying to intercept data that's passing over telecom networks. And 48% went to private individuals and small to medium businesses.
Well, and they haven't really identified the infection vector. Again, this is one of the aspects of it that is inherently modular. So they believe they found an instance where Yahoo Instant Messenger was exploited through an unverified vector in Yahoo Instant Messenger. But, you know, even in looking at this really closely, because it does it spends so much effort in obfuscating its own operation, it's difficult for people who even know it's there to know what it's doing.
Right. This is actually one of the things we brought up with Raphael Mudge when he talked about advanced persistent threats. It obfuscates its communication. So it's using random ports, or it uses ports of commonly used network tools. Like, for example, it will use ping. It will use the FTP ports. So even if you're looking at traffic through your network, it won't necessarily seem like bad traffic.
Hiding in plain sight,
which is the best way to do it. Let me bring in my other co-host here, Curtis. We say that this is not a IP malware. This is not going after trade secrets. This is not one of those pieces of malware that was able to download gigabytes of information on some secure project. But that's not to say that this wouldn't still be useful in the enterprise. I'm just thinking specifically if you were able to follow the executives of a competing company, that in and of itself is an incredible intelligence tool, is it not?
Oh, it absolutely would be. And, you know, let's look at what some of the common features of the countries that are you know, being primarily affected here. Russia, Saudi Arabia, Mexico, the thing that they all have in common is oil. And if you can figure out who's talking to whom about oil, that could give you some major insight into what could be happening with oil prices. And we know that a very small bit of insight into what's going to happen with oil prices can mean billions upon billions of dollars in someone's pocket. So the rationale for and incentive to infect telecom companies to find that kind of information is tremendous.
Well, and we know the power of metadata. And for example, who is booking hotel reservations where tells you who is meeting with who. Mm-hmm. And so you can make inferences even without listening to people's conversations. You know, we've talked famously about like cellular phone metadata and how, well, you know, from looking at the interconnections of cellular phones, you can determine an awful lot about someone, even if you don't listen to the conversations. Well, things like hotel reservations and airline flights is real world metadata of, you know, who people are meeting with and where they're traveling. And exactly as Curtis was saying, that sort of says, oh, look, this sheikh is over here now having a meeting probably with these people who are located in that city. And from that, you're able to make inferences. The other thing we haven't talked about yet is this also contains a sophisticated remote access Trojan, a so-called RAT, which is capable of capturing screenshots from the machine that it's resident in, taking over the user's mouse point and click operations, stealing passwords, monitoring that local machine's network traffic, and even recovering files that have previously been deleted from its hard drive.
Okay, we can kind of laugh at it because as far as we know, there are no infections in the United States. It seems
none of us are infected.
None of us are infected.
But none of us have it.
But on the other side, Steve, I got to be thinking, well, we can't be the only one working on a tool like this. Maybe Regan was a nation state sponsored malware, But there's got to be other countries that are working on exactly the same thing. Yes?
Yep.
It's an arm race, right?
Yep.
All right. Let me ask you some technical stuff here. We know that it's difficult to track because it's obfuscating its communications, and it's also so modularized, compartmentalized, that it's often difficult to know that you've been infected until after it's already sent out a payload.
And it's polymorphic in communications. That is, it simultaneously has all these different modules, and so it can adaptively look at the environment it's in and, like, look at, oh, look, there's a huge amount of web traffic going on. I'm going to send out communications in web queries encoded in the cookie values of headers. So, wow. I mean, it actually does that. So that's one of the capabilities. So you could have, like, any one of us who are used to looking at networks traffic sniffing, staring at queries that it is making, and we would look at them and think they look just fine. Because we're all used to seeing cookies that have gibberish as their values. You know, crypto stuff is what we call it. And we don't know that that's actually a password that's been encrypted, that it captured from the keyboard, that it is sending out semi-innocently by having added it to query headers.
Right. And we know that it uses a custom-built encryption for a custom-built encrypted file system so that it can store its payload on the target computer until it's ready to send it out, and we won't even know it's there.
It has its own virtual file system that it installs in the operating system so that it's able to manage its own file archive separately from the regular OS file system and not appear in the OS file system.
And it uses an RC5 variant. So that's RC5. Yep. It's been slightly altered for communications encryption. So even if you were to intercept, as you said, staring at the screen, watching the stream, we would have no idea what it's actually sending.
Right. Okay. And it hides in plain sight.
It hides in plain sight. So I got to ask, what's the defense about this? I mean, we've been talking about advanced persistent threats, and that most of the time, defense is, I figure out that I've been hacked 3 weeks down the line. Is there a way to actually intercept this between stages, maybe after the loader or after stage one? Or is this just one of these things where you just wipe everything because you assume something's been compromised?
Reformat.
Wow, really? Wow. Okay. All right. Well, I'm scared. Thank you, Steve Gibson. We can come back to this in a bit, but I have to stop shaking first. So let's move to something that I think is actually a good story. You were talking a little bit about the EFS's new Let's Encrypt initiative. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, so we're all familiar with the general push to encrypt more of our communications. We now know that there are agencies that are well-financed and actively interested in monitoring everything, just a huge vacuum cleaner, essentially sucking in all of our communications. It is much more difficult to do that, to decrypt. I mean, there are ways, but it is more difficult to decrypt encrypted communications like HTTPS stuff that you're doing with websites than the communications that's typically unencrypted, like email. But even though there are benefits to running over encryption, the numbers vary, but it's still about 10% of internet websites bother with encryption. So many of them don't. Like, you know, blogging sites, you could argue, okay, who cares about someone's blog? Why bother encrypting it? But there are two barriers to this. One is that it's still the case that setting up a server and getting it encrypted takes conservatively hours. You have to, it's not something that's in your normal path of operation. Even I, who've been running encrypted servers for as long as I've had servers, the certificates expire every 2 or 3 years, which is just long enough for me to have forgotten what the process is. And so if nothing else, you have to relearn exactly what buttons to push and how to get a certificate signing request out of your server and send it somewhere. So it's burdensome to do. And then certificates are not free. Typically, you pay hundreds of dollars per year. Longer certs, you sort of get to average out over the years because they would like to get more money from you up front. That is the certificate authorities. So they're not free and they're not easy. So a consortium of large companies that everyone has heard of, the EFF, Mozilla, Akamai, the University of Michigan is doing a bunch of research, and Cisco, they've all gathered together. They're forming a new organization. The goal is to solve all of those problems. They're going to create drop-in, single-click software for all of the popular servers on the net. And they have designed now a new protocol called ACME, A-C-M-E. And I don't have it in front of me what it stands for, but it's automated something or other. Anyways, what it does is it's an agent that, there it is, Automated Certificate Management Environment. So that, okay, that was an awkward acronym. They, you know, it's one of those where they had to say, okay, what can we use for E? Environment. That's generic. Anyway, so you run an agent in the server, and through this protocol, this new protocol, the certificate authority tells the server to prove that it has control of the domain. And we've seen this before. You know, there was the personal identity system where you put a specific page on your site. In fact, Google uses this sometimes to like verify that you have control of a domain. You put something, you demonstrate you can control pages on that appear on a web domain. And that's enough to say that, okay, whoever we're communicating to obviously controls that domain. They're controlling the server, and they have proven that by creating a page that then the certificate authority is able to pull from. Then this agent installed on the server generates a public key pair and provides its public key to the server, signs some stuff that the server gives it, and establishes through this crypto, you know, basically simple crypto, that entity installed in the server has control of the domain. And at that point, that entity, this agent, is able to generate certificate signing requests, and through this ACME protocol, get the certificate from the certificate authority at no charge. None of this costs anything, and install it into its server and set up the configuration files, creating a log of all the changes it made. So basically, somebody who has never done this before, knows nothing about it, can download a piece of software, run it on their server, and in a matter of minutes, their server is secure. And revocation, in the case that they ever lost control of that certificate, is also automated, as is renewal. So not only is the server secure, but you just set it and forget it. And when the certificate becomes close to expiration, it renews its conversation with this new free CA that's being established and updates the certificate. And so they're not expiring on you. It's not a nightmare. It's just it's called letsencrypt.org, and it's due to come online in the second quarter of next year, of 2015.
So it makes it easy for everyone to get a free certificate. It makes it easy for people to maintain their free certificates. And it basically makes it easy for us to encrypt the entire web.
The thing it makes really hard and awkward is explaining why you don't have security.
Yeah, actually, yes.
No more excuses.
It used to be, well, certificate's expensive, or I don't have the manpower to keep it updated.
I don't
updated.
Really need it.
Right.
No, I'm not doing anything secure. Hey, moron, it's free. Press the button and you got security.
They even handle the management for you. So technically, this would be easier to manage than any sort of homebrew security you may add to your site.
It is the no excuses security system.
Okay, I got to ask, Steve, there's a couple of questions here. The first is, if this is for free, and if this management is as good as it seems to be, it's standard space, it uses a JSON template, then why would you buy an expensive certificate? What is there something extra you would get if you got it from a CA that might sell it to you for $1,500?
Yes, perfect question. There are three classifications of certificates. There's the DV, the so-called domain validation cert. Then there's the OV, which is the organization validation. And then the EV, which is the so-called extended validation. Even though this exists and certs are now free, I will continue to use extended validation certificates because I want the extra glamour of the green URL when anyone goes to grc.com, because what that says is more, it's making a much stronger assertion of the identity, the authentication of the certificate. Because this is automated, the only assertion that is being made is that you have a secure connection to the domain name you have gone to, but it says nothing about the entity that owns that domain name. So Gibson Research Corporation is a legal corporation that has grc.com. So I want to bind the Gibson Research Corporation assertion of ownership of the corporate entity to the domain name, and then the certificate holds all that together. That's what you pay for, because you still can't automate that. There's faxes, there's phone calls, you talk to people, they actually do actual human intelligence research to make that assertion. And so it takes, it's not a few minutes to get that first cert. It's, maybe a few hours to a day. And sometimes more than that. But what you get for your money is a much stronger binding of a legal corporate entity to the cryptographic assertion that is in the certificate. So you are getting something for your money. On the other hand, many people don't need that. A blog doesn't need that. What it needs is, it would be nice if it weren't so easy to eavesdrop on it.
Right. Right. And actually, Chibert, we're going to be talking to him in a bit because he's got an interesting slant on this using a different technology, DNS Dane. But before that, I want to talk to Curtis really quickly and ask this. Curtis, you've said on multiple occasions, encrypt, encrypt, encrypt. You just want everything encrypted. And one of the things that you said it would be good about everybody encrypting is it removes the low-hanging fruit. If all the traffic is encrypted, this would even benefit those enterprises that aren't using the service, right? I mean, if everything from the lowly blog up to the SMB website has at least some form of encryption that obfuscates the traffic that's flowing through that switch somewhere in some place that has some sort of tap attached to it, then even the enterprise who is not spending money on this, who is going with the more expensive certificate with an IT team that's managing their certificates, even they would benefit from this Let's Encrypt initiative from the EFF, yes?
Oh, I certainly think so. The bad news is that much like the antivirus hand-washing stuff, what this does is weed out the weak ones, leaving the strong ones to do even more bad stuff. But by creating an environment in which encryption is assumed, then it absolutely does take away the incentive to try a lot of the, as we said, low-hanging fruit type of attacks. Now, the flip side is that any organization or individual that doesn't encrypt paints a big target on them. And I suppose we can all be grateful for them for being willing to attract the attention of all the script kiddies out there. That's a wonderful public service for them to keep those bad people occupied. But for those who are serious, the expectation that everything will be encrypted is nothing but good for the overall security environment of the internet. And I think it's a good positive step forward.
Chiebert, you've got a slightly different approach to the same solution. You want to do this through DNS. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, keep in mind, I'm not saying it's one or the other. I'm saying it probably should be both, because we still need some sort of third-party validation of identity. You know, so I'm not going to argue that point. What I am going to say is having a trusted DNS, getting rid of, you know, getting people to actually adopt DNSSEC makes an awful lot of sense. And what the IETF is working on with DNS Dane is providing you a carrot on why you should go and implement DNSSEC. Because once you can trust the identity of the DNS, what's to keep us from putting the public key in there? Makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now all of a sudden,
I completely agree.
Yeah. Now you can afford to encrypt individual machines, the blog, the streaming video server. We can do a lot of interesting things. But yeah, I do like Acme in that I want to be able to go and have some sort of overlying authority, a third party involved saying, yes, this really and truly is a person. Because the weak link here is DNSSEC. It has to be implemented correctly. And having two different mesh technologies that mesh together nicely makes a heck of a lot of sense. And I've actually set up PKI facilities, and I grew very old implementing them. They are not fun to set up. We need something a lot easier. We need something that people are willing to do. We need something that could be driven by an installation wizard. We need something so that ubiquitous strong encryption is something that's done as part of the norm rather than the exception.
Steve, I want to give you the last thoughts on this. One last question would be, how can this be self-sustaining? I mean, if they're giving this away, if they're making this a free service, a free tool for anyone who wants to have a certificate on their site, I understand that they have partners, but there's still some sort of administration and some sort of infrastructure that needs to be built up at the EFF. That's not free. And if they don't have a way to make it self-sustaining, then they don't have a way to make this long-lived. What is the mechanism behind that?
I don't have an answer. I mean, you raise a really good point. The only thing I could say is that, as you said, there are major entities who have gotten together to do this. And, the fact is, this stuff isn't very expensive. I mean, you need some bandwidth, you need some servers, but as a fraction of how large the EFF is, or what facilities Mozilla already has, or Lord knows what facilities Cisco has, I mean, this could fit in a small crumb of a corner of any of those organizations. So, and it really looks like they've designed it from scratch to be low overhead, low maintenance, and to fit in an automated framework.
Gentlemen, I want to thank all of you for being on this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I'm sorry, but we have reached the end of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 4 out of 5 stages of the region malware. Steve Gibson, SGRC.com, I want to thank you. It's always a pleasure to speak with you in any capacity. Could you please tell the members of the Twilight Riot where they can find you, where they can find your work, of course, GRC.com, and where they can find your show here on the Twit TV network?
I do want to just amplify one thing that Brian said, because I'm 100% with him. I've mentioned on my Security Now podcast, I say it often, that if we can ever get to a point where DNS is signed, which is what essentially DNSSEC is, where we have basically a secure, ubiquitous, cached, worldwide, global directory. Right now, we have that for domain names, but it can do so much more. If we can ever get there, we have a fabulous facility. But 2 weeks ago, I spoke at a conference, a security conference in Las Vegas, and I was in the audience when one of the other presenters asked for a show of hands of how many people were using security and SSL certificates. And 80%. I mean, it was a security conference, so you'd expect maybe a skewed group. You know, almost everybody raised their hands. And then the person said, how many of you are using DNSSEC? Not one
crickets.
Hand. Not mine.
Crickets.
Nobody, no one's. And I mean, we really have an adoption problem, but boy, it would be wonderful to have it.
We're actually having Cricket Lou. He's the big push behind DNSSEC. He will be back on the show, I believe, in January. So we have that to look forward to. But I know you're going to be talking about this more tomorrow on Security Now, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So this was just the start of the conversation. I'm sorry we were only able to use about 40 minutes for this. But if you want to know more about this malware, if you want to know more about Let's Encrypt, you got to tune in tomorrow for Security Now. Steve, what time is that?
It is 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock. No, wait. Yeah. 1 o'clock
yeah.
Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern. I'm going to go through the entire ACME protocol in detail. That is the topic for tomorrow's Security Now, is the Let's Encrypt protocol and technology. And I will be a little more deeply covering Region, whatever we call it.
It's just a weird name. Steve Gibson, GRC.com. Thanks, you again.
Padre.
We will have you back to scare the willies out of us as soon as you possibly can.
Deal.
I also want to thank my co-host, starting with Brian Chibert, the geek in paradise. Chibert, what you got planned for Turkey Day?
Family gathering, which is very nice. Not sure how much a turkey day I'm actually going to get, because we are head down trying to get modifications made to our new deep dive ROV. And if we can actually get this sucker working, I'm working on fiber optics tomorrow. If we can get it working, we are going to be able to visit the Aloha Cabled Observatory more often and add more experiments.
And hopefully you'll have your streaming box up so we could always watch and listen to the ocean 3.5 miles down.
I'm just waiting on a real license because, you know, demo versions, they cripple a lot of key features.
There you go. You know, there's a lot of streaming companies that should be offering you money right now just to have your stream on their service. But we'll get to that in a future episode. Curtis Franklin at Information Week Radio. I know that you are gearing up for a couple events. Can you tell the Twilight Riot where you'll be heading out?
Well, let's see. We could spend Thanksgiving here in the swamp, getting ready for a couple of things, CES. And we're also beginning next week to gear up for Interop. Interop is a big, big deal. And on Tuesday, December 2nd, we will start Interop Radio. Check my Twitter feed. I'll have URLs and more information. We'll tell you we're going to be featuring the inestimable Glenn Evans in episode one.
Fantastic. Gentlemen, thank you, Juan. Thank you all for being part of the episode. I also want to thank you. That's right, our loyal listener, our loyal watcher, our loyal audience, for coming back each and every single week for your fill of enterprise goodness. Now, to thank you for doing that, in fact, a Thanksgiving for doing that would be the fact that if you go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat, you can find not just all of our episodes, but also places where you can automatically download our episodes in whatever format you want to your device of choice. It's one of the things that we do for the Twit Army. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter. That's right. Just go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. And you'll find out what I do on every episode of Twit. In fact, every episode of what I do here on Twit, including when I'm trying to fly quadcopters on my quadcopter field and a football team shows up. Which, you know, it's weird stuff like that that's going to make you want to follow the digital Jesuit. Don't forget that we also do this show live every Monday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. You're going to find us at live.twit.tv. If you watch us live, you'll be able to see the stream. You see what we do before and after the show and all the bloopers that get cut out of the finished mix. And as long as you're watching live, go ahead and jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv. There you'll be able to talk to me during the show. I've got you guys right up there, right above the camera, so I can find out what you're saying and I can answer your questions if it's appropriate for us to bring it up during our discussion. Again, it's part of the experiment that is Twit TV. Don't forget that we thank everyone here, all these people who make this show possible. That includes Lisa and Leo to Karsten, my super producer, and of course, my TD, Cranky Hippo, the bane of my existence, Brian Burnett. Brian, can you tell the folks where you are?
Yeah, you can follow me at Cranky_Hippo on Twitter, and Thursday's doing know-how with you, although this Thursday, I guess, we'll be enjoying our respective Thanksgiving. So tune in following week, and go check out the site, see what, some of the other crazy quad stuff we've been doing. Back to you, Padre.
Thank you, Brian. Remember, folks, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.